Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Justin Arner from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Today's episode will be a bit different. We're going to look back at the 2023 annual meeting with ANA in New Orleans and talk to a few of the presenters that we heard from. The first being Dr. Patkowski from San Antonio in the military.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Justin Arner from the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Jean Patkowski. She's in San Antonio in the chair there. We just heard a great talk from her this morning about pan-labral repairs and some tips and tricks related to that. So we were going to speak a little bit about that and her practice and her role as the chairwoman in San Antonio. So first of all, let's chat about your talk this morning. So great talk. One thing, you know, early in practice, I had challenging issues with fluid extravasation with these big tears that, you know, having a systematic type of sequence. So can you just give us a little recap? You know, you mentioned about sometimes starting up at the biceps and a little bit about your thought process and philosophy with those types of tears.
Sure, absolutely. So they are a relatively rare pathology, but for whatever reason, we do tend to see more of these combined labral lesions in the panlabral tears in the military population. And whether that's just because of just their daily occupational requirements, or I think also just a sense of pushing through things. We have a lot of folks who want to get through a mission, get through a deployment before they get their injuries taken care of. And so by the time we see them, that pathology is really just increased quite a bit. So in terms of addressing them, you know, it's, I think just really having an organized approach to it is the most important component. The principles are the same, right? You want to get your anchors low. You want to get multiple points of fixation. You want to shift your capsule up. You want to have everything balanced. But when that tissue is so incredibly mobile and just detached circumferentially, it can be really hard to control. And so I've had so many times where the lasso will just hub out and you're just struggling so hard to get it right. And so your percutaneous portals, really making sure your portals are perfect. My partners and I always joke around, be sure versus lateral really doesn't send a matter. I go back and forth in my practice just based on different patients. I think it's nice for the resident education too for them to see that, but really just making sure from the very beginning those portals are perfect, and if they're not, change them, right? Don't be afraid to just put that extra incision on to get to where you need to be. I think there's been so many great innovations in the technology too that you can really get down lower than you used to be able to. You've got curved drill guides, straight drill guides, really, like the world is, I think, is your oyster, and it's just a matter of how are you the most comfortable and most facile at getting the job done. I think, again, going to the top can be a nice place to start when everything is taken off, just because you have that landmark, that biceps anchor. As long as that's still attached, I can really guide you as to where you can get one point started where you know it's anatomic and then build the rest of your repair from there. But I think whether you start in the front, you start in the back, I don't think it matters too much. And certainly the literature suggests that it doesn't.
One thing I thought was interesting in your talk is you mentioned, and I've struggled with the amount of capsule to grab, and like you talked about hubbing out, and did you call it the nip and tuck?
Or the pinch
the
tuck.
Pinch and tuck. Nip and tuck is maybe a different subspecialty.
Right,
tell
exactly.
Us a little bit about that. I've never done that.
Yeah, before. And so JT Chokish taught us that years ago at an anastomos course, and I think it's been so valuable, not only just for the regular anterior and posterior labral cases, but certainly these panlabrals. And so when you want that big bite of capsule, but you can't get all the way around the length of the lasso or your suture passing device, just grab deep at the bite of the capsule first and then come out with that needle tip. And then you can take a second pass entirely around the labrum, and that really nicely pinches all that tissue together in a way that's just a lot easier to control when things are so mobile.
Yeah. That's a good trick rather than trying to torque on the passer. I've broken one before, which is always a little nerve-wracking.
So miserable to get that out, right?
It.
Exactly.
So, you know, one other thing that other speakers were talking about, are you a big fan? You mentioned the percutaneous type portals. Are you doing a lot of 6 o'clock anchors and posterior anchors if it's more an anterior based thing? Like you mentioned, the military is a different population. I'm sure you're seeing way more multiple dislocators than a lot of others, and more posterior instability too.
Sure. Yeah, I think when it's just a simple anterior bank heart, then I do like to go around and put that 7 o'clock, just more posterior anchor in too, just to, again, really balance that hammock and bring everything up inferiorly. If it's a case where I'm doing a remplissage at the same time, I'm less likely to do that because I think you get that same sort of effect from the remplissage. So,
yeah. It's to be determined, and continually we're learning. So,
yeah.
One other thing we were mentioning before we started recording was a little bit about your chairwoman job. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and your current title and what you do for the military, because we were speaking before that there aren't any other chairwomen in the military, and certainly not many in the civilian realm either.
Sure. It's absolutely been an interesting journey. Not the sort of path that I thought I was going to take when I first started getting into residency, and certainly even just completing fellowship. I think that I owe a lot of time to the militaries. And so under those circumstances, eventually you're either going to be at the table helping to make some of those decisions, or you're just not going to have a voice. And watching, you know, in some of our institutions, what can happen there when physicians just relinquish that leadership responsibility, I think, just can really have some devastating consequences. I'm a problem solver at heart, and so the chair path I thought was a little bit more intriguing to me than, say, the GME path. But I think they're just both incredibly valuable and important positions inside the hospitals. So it's been a huge learning experience. I've been in this job now about 18 months, and there's a lot to learn. I think every day there's days where I feel like, man, I have really just messed everything up today, and the stone is just rolled all the way right back down the mountain. And then you have days where you feel like maybe it's slow and steady progress, but you realize that, yes, there's gains that are being made. And I think just so much of it has been communication. And like we were just talking about with the diversity panel, really trying to figure out what is it that drives people? What is it that motivates them? What is it that's going to help them get to that next stage in their development? And recognizing that not everybody wants the same path. Not everybody has the same interests and the same passions. And I think one of my friends said it best, you love all your children by treating them differently. And so recognizing those differences and how you can apply them to that person's situation. And if all you're doing is just removing the hurdles from the really motivated person, then that's great. But if you're also just trying to sit down with that other person that doesn't know what they want to do and who they want to be in life. So I think those can be the parts of it that are really satisfying and make up for those days that just feel incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. Very well said. Certainly in my own little world, certainly not like yours, but trying to just manage a few people on your personal team with different personalities and things is something that we don't really have training for like any other people in business. And right. Tell us a little bit about how you've leaned on mentors or how you've kind of learned this leadership path, because your military training is certainly different than ours.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've had great mentors, both civilian and military as well. And I think just those people, again, that recognizing and I guess just really seeing and wanting to invest that time to develop people, right? Because that's, I think, the important part of a person like a chair or a program director is to say, I have this platform and I can use it to help you. I'm going to look down and in and to bring you up because you're that next generation. And so I really benefited from people that wanted to do that level of mentorship and sponsorship, and then just trying to figure out how can I then turn that and pay that forward, right? I think on the civilian side, ANA has been just such an important organization for me, because there's always been this sense of I come to an ANA meeting, I can talk to a world expert, and they don't feel put out that, like, who's this person who's so junior coming and asking these questions. People are really excited here to share what they've learned. And it's not this sense of hoarding knowledge and I have to keep it to myself to be on top. That's what I really love about ANA. And I think that from a leadership perspective, a clinical research, every kind of perspective, this is a meeting where I come and I enjoy the interactions with people. I learn an incredible amount and I walk away feeling like I've just made true connections. And I just think that's so incredibly valuable and why I love coming here.
Certainly, Anna, and I have the same experience with being unique as inclusive of residents and junior residents and mentorship. They really have been in front of that. So I feel the same. You're welcomed as, you know, a junior resident coming here, trying to learn, saying, like, what are they doing here? Just trying to gather some knowledge. And it's very inclusive.
We're back after that discussion we had in the exhibit hall with Dr. Patkowski, and we're going to stay on the same topic of anterior shoulder instability and talk a little bit more about bony type work with Dr. Galvin, who presented some of Dr. Boileau's research at the annual meeting in New Orleans.
So I'm Joe Galvin from Madigan Army Medical Center. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, mainly doing shoulder and elbow surgery.
Joseph Galvin, we're thankful to have him here today. We were just speaking a little bit about his unique training and gave Pascual Boileau's talk today, An Opinion Versus Screws and Buttons. So could you first talk a little bit about your training and seeing, you know, your extensive experience spending time in Europe, their philosophy versus your training in the United States, and your unique military population, what you've kind of gathered from both sides of the ocean?
Sure. Yeah, so I did fellowship with J.P. Warner in Boston. And as part of that, spent 3 months in Europe with first with Christian Gerber, then a month with Pascal Boileau, and a month with Laurent Lafosse. And so, you know, they all kind of manage things a little bit differently. Christian Gerber, you know, I asked him, you know, what's your indication for bank heart repair? You know, how much bone loss? Or he said, I don't have an indication for bank heart repair. So you have that side of the spectrum there. But they pretty much in Switzerland were doing primarily open ladder J, and fairly aggressive with it. And a lot of that is based on the evidence and the kind of the classic Zimmerman Gerber paper in JBJS 2016 that had, you know, 30 to 40% failure of arthroscopic bank heart versus, you know, there's a 3% redislocation rate with their ladder J. So they're very evidence based. And then after that experience, went to Nice, France with Pascal Boileau, who's also very aggressive with arthroscopic ladder J. And so got to see his experience with his cortical button system. And he's obviously a very skilled and kind of masterful surgeon who's, you know, probably done 1,000 arthroscopic ladder J's. And as you saw in the presentation, has gotten very good healing rates and outcomes from that. And then moved on from there to watch Laurent Lafosse, you know, do an arthroscopic ladder J in 59 minutes, but he uses screws. And so when I came back to, you know, when I transitioned out of fellowship and came back to Madigan, trying to synthesize all of that data in addition to what I'd learned in the military during residency, you know, I had to come up with my own kind of practice algorithm. And I think the most important thing that as I started practicing and, you know, working amongst other sports partners and surgeons in the community was understanding what the standard of care is in the U.S. because we're not in Europe anymore. And so in Europe, it was very aggressive, obviously, for ladder J, and they do a lot of these things based on the evidence, but in the U.S., it's a different ballgame, I think. And so I try to be very strict on the indications for open ladder J. And I've probably done maybe 30 to 35 over the past 3 to 4 years with, and as you know, in the military, it's just high volume instability. Through actually the Anna Somos initiative, I had the opportunity to go down and spend 3 weeks with JT Tokish down in Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And that was kind of a transformative experience, not just from the life lessons and leadership and mentorship that he provided, but also kind of learning his arthroscopic remplissage technique with kind of the double pulley, single incision. And so after I went down there, coming back, having that as another tool in the kit bag to, you know, it's not just bank heart versus ladder J, it's now you have this technique in the middle that you can do quickly and well and potentially decrease complication rate for that kind of subcritical bipolar off track lesion. That's been a huge help. And so I think, you know, as you saw from the presentation, the last couple slides, the other thing that I've learned from Pascal Boileau was his kind of arthroscopic Eden-Hibonet technique. And so I haven't adopted his arthroscopic ladder J technique with buttons, but I've had 3 cases now where I've used the cortical button fixation with iliac crest, and you're drilling from back to front. You pass the graft through the rotator interval, you're lateral to the conjoin, you take all of the neurovascular structure risk off the table, and you can do a bank heart repair to make it extra articular. And in 2 of the cases, I added a remplissage using Tokish's technique because the patients had, you know, very deep off-track Hill Sachs lesions. So so that's kind of been the evolution for me. And it's basically, you know, learning from, you know, kind of expert surgeons and had the opportunity to do that, which has been nice. So
it's a unique perspective being able to see all these different master surgeons from different avenues and different parts of the world, and being able to synthesize what works in your community is certainly a skill set. So for the people that weren't able to be at the meeting, tell us a little bit about your thought process, the data, the overall decision making with cortical buttons versus screws, if you could give kind of a summary in your opinion as well.
Yeah, I think the first thing I think is the debate over screws or buttons. I think screws have kind of stood the test of time. It's you achieve excellent fixation. We've all seen the complications of screws backing out or breaking. I think the majority, in my experience, the majority of complications with screws, I think it's almost kind of this bimodal. So you have the within a year complications, which are typically screws backing out. And from what I've seen from cases that have been referred to me, they're typically screws that have a high divergence. And so they're not placed at a good, almost perpendicular angle to the glenoid. And so those grafts go on to non-union, and the screws will back out, or they become symptomatic because the graft resorbs. So that's kind of one population of screw-related complications. And then the second is like the longer-term follow-up where the superior portion of the graft will resorb, and then it's irritating the subscap or the plexus. And so I think that's a real problem, as you saw in the presentation. And I think that's an area where potentially cortical buttons can obviate the need for a secondary surgery later on to take out hardware. So I quoted one of the papers by Greaser et al. And it was published in JSES 2013, where 35% of reoperations were due to needing to take the screws out. So if you don't have to undergo another operation because you use cortical buttons, maybe that's a win. The cortical button, from listening to Ivan Wong's data, I think it's a great study. I would not use cortical buttons with a distal tibial allograft. I think that seems pretty clear. The experience that from extrapolating from Pascal Boileau's, when you tension it to 100 newtons three times, you can achieve good healing at that interface. Before I did the first case with cortical buttons, I actually had heard from one of the implant company reps that Albert G up in University of Washington was using a similar system and having good results. So I actually called him. He doesn't know me, but I called him up and I wanted to get his opinion. He said, yeah, I've been using this, and my partner and I have been using this, and we've been achieving good healing rates. So that, along with Pascal Boileau's experience, kind of emboldened me to do it. And the three cases that I've done it in have achieved union and good outcomes. So I think you can achieve good outcomes, but clearly like more study is needed. Obviously good studies with CT scan follow-ups before I think you can say definitively that it's safe.
Great talk today, and thanks for sharing your opinions and experience. Such a unique training opportunity, which
thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
That'll wrap up our discussion with Dr. Patkowski and Dr. Galvin at the 2023 ANA annual meeting in New Orleans. I'd like to thank them for their time and excellent discussions, both on the podium and in the exhibit hall.
This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.